We're going to have a series of public hearing and work sessions today, hopefully, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 160. We have had an amendment to it. Now I have four people who signed up. We will have a public hearing. We're going to have a work session, and I'll let our esteemed administrator explain to you what our amendment is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 160 allows the Department of Human Services to require a prescribing practitioner to request prior authorization of payment for medically appropriate drugs not listed on the practitioner-managed prescription drug list. And the effect of the amendment prohibits DHS from requiring prior authorization for antipsychotic medications. I also do want to read into the record that we have a written testimony from the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon in support of Senate Bill 160.
Amended.
Just Senate Bill 160.
Oh, okay. Okay. Bill Oeriger, would you come up, please? Shirley Kimball. Now, if you have written testimony, we'll take your written testimony and please summarize, if you would, your written testimony for us. And speak from the heart, not from the paper, right? Right. Thank you. Go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Dr. Bill Oeriger. I'm a member of the Health Resources Commission. My specialty is family practice. This is my 31st year in medicine in Oregon. I started as a family doctor in Albany in 1977 and practiced full-time for 19 years, then began 11 years ago in medical administration. My job now is a medical director for Samaritan Corvallis, Samaritan Health Plans, and we administer several health plans, including an Oregon Health Plan intermediary. And I have a lot of experience with this, some of which was down home and personal. In 1996, as I was beginning my administrative career, our capitated Oregon Health Plan was operating under the present way the open card is operating. We had a formulary where anybody could prescribe anything. And quite honestly, we were losing our shirts financially. So I was given the job of writing a closed formulary. Now, I'm a small-town family doctor. I'm not an expert in anything. And not lacking in self-confidence, I took it on. But the commitment I made to my colleagues, who I practiced with for 20 years, and they know where I live, well, I live a block from the hospital, they can find me, was that all of my decisions would be evidence-based. And any of my drug criteria would be backed up by published evidence. And I still live in the same place, and I still have the job, despite some challenges. And when you have a program that's evidence-based, the challenges are based on the evidence. And that's kind of interesting. You know, what does this article prove? What's the limits of this research? And that's not what I think or what you think, but what does the evidence show? And that's really the best way to make medical decisions. Now, there's some very good questions from some of the senators last week, and I have to refer to my notes there. One of the questions was, gee, why do doctors need this? Shouldn't they know better? Well, yeah, I wish they did. But the answers are physicians are human, like the rest of us. There are 30,000 prescription drugs on the market. Things change fairly frequently. And drug pricing is probably at the bottom of the list on some physicians' agenda. They want to know that the drug is safe and effective, more so than what it costs. Our present system for Open Card Oregon Health Plan has no incentive whatsoever to even ask what something costs. So there's no incentive for the physician or the patient. As compared to the private plans, including the one I have, where there is prior authorization for some things, and other things are tiered with higher copays, once again, based on evidence. Second question was also a good one. Geez, is there really that much money in this? Yes, there is. In our plan, Lynn and Benton counties have approximately 200,000 people with a state population of 3 million. We're roughly 7% of the state. In our little plan, we saved $1 million the first year. Do Did any of our other costs go up? No. We had no more hospitalizations, no more emergency room visits. In fact, our emergency room visits dropped because of some other things we did. Why is there so much money in this? There are a lot of Me Too drugs. Drugs that are very similar, where there's a generic form or a cheaper form, identical to some brand name drugs. Common example, OTC Prilosec, an acid-blocking drug, $26 a month. Identical in safety effectiveness as the purple pill advertised on TV, which is $140 a month. You can be assured if it's advertised on TV, it's at least $1,000 a year. The other good question was, what about new drugs? As part of the Health Services Commission, we hire OHSU to do rigorous evaluations based on public evidence, published evidence of drugs. And we have a regular update committee, of which I'm the chair, and drugs are evaluated annually. Some categories, there isn't much change, and it's less often. Before drugs are approved, there has to be evidence that's presented to the FDA. That evidence then becomes public information, and you can find out a lot about a drug before it's approved. Often there's public published information. Sometimes drugs come from other countries. So we can find out. And many of our so-called new drugs are recycled old drugs or Me Too drugs. They're a branded, high-priced drug that's very similar to something else. And that's probably 80% of new drugs. The really new drugs, being an early adopter is a mixed bag. Drugs are studied for 3 to 12 months on maybe a couple thousand people before they're released, where they may be used for years by millions of people. And there isn't enough in the research that's done to sort out that 1 in 50,000 side effect or that toxicity that occurs in the third or fifth year. So there are some risks to being the very first, but once again, we update things. I support the amendment of because I think we heard last week some compelling reasons why antipsychotic drugs are truly different and must be individualized. So I think this amendment is positive. You know, if right now we're paying for the subscription to Consumers Reports, but we're not using the information. We're paying for the evidence that is gathered and used by a lot of other states, but we're not using it. So what are the alternatives? Well, gee, I guess we could have some other alternatives to evidence-based medicine. We could have advertising-based medicine. You know, advertising works pretty well. Gosh, look at $4 cups of coffee and bottled water. Why on earth would anybody buy any of that based on evidence? And I'm a $4 coffee guy myself. So I think this is a step in the right direction. And therefore, as a practicing physician and one involved in interpreting drug research, I support this.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. I'm Shirley Kimball from McMinnville, Oregon, Yamhill County. I worked in mental health in a treatment program for mentally ill for 17 years, and now I work as an advocate for people with mental illness through National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I'm certainly happy to hear that you have amended Senate Bill 160 to exclude psychotropic drugs. And so I shall speak to the bills requiring doctors or physicians to get a waiver or get authorization for medications they may deem more suitable to their patient than those on the formulary. Now, this is what I know can happen. The doctor phones the pharmacy or the agency to get the waiver. What happens then? Does the pharmacist quickly make a determination? In that case, it's done quite with not the care that the doctor has given to the patient's condition. And if not, if the doctor or the physician has to submit a written request with supporting evidence of needing a particular drug, then how long does that take? Does it take a day? Does it take, or does the physician say, well, come back this afternoon. I'll see if I can get the prescription by then. Or does the physician say, wait outside for half an hour and maybe I'll have it by then. Well, this is a patient who has a brain disorder. It isn't a patient who can sit outside and contemplate their aching bones or their aching stomach. It's a person who can't think about the brain disorder.
Let me interrupt. Are you familiar with the amendment?
Yes, I am.
We're going to.
Yes. Okay. So we're talking about antidepressants, aren't we? I am talking about antidepressants and other medications. And this patient typically is very anxious. And after 10, 20, 30 minutes, what happens? He or she bolts. Then what does the physician do? How does he find this person? How does she find this patient? Maybe not. Sometimes they end up in emergency room care. Sometimes their public behavior elicits law enforcement officers. These are worst case scenarios, but the worst case scenario is that patient is suffering great distress and great distrust in the county mental health system, and we can't afford that. I have every confidence in physicians being able to prescribe to the best of their ability and their knowledge without being hamstrung by the rest of Senate Bill 160. So thank you.
Thank you. Kathleen Cosgrove, would you come up, please? And Alice Herron.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Cosgrove. I'm the lobbyist for Cascade AIDS Project, and I'm also a former board member for Cascade AIDS. I recently stepped down as president of the organization. I've been with them for 6 years. I'm here to testify or to speak to our opposition of Senate Bill 160 in its current form. Historically, life-saving
Catherine, its current form or with the amendment?
With the amendment.
With the amendment. Okay.
Also, just because we would like to see an additional amendment to it. We have no objection to the amendment that has been presented. Historically, life-saving antiretroviral treatment drugs for HIV and AIDS have not been on the practitioner-managed prescription drug list. This is because the drugs are constantly changing and the cocktails that are needed to provide this life-saving treatment are changing on a regular basis. This is not, as our previous speaker spoke to, Me Too drugs. No one is taking these drugs unless they absolutely have to and their life is in danger. We are seeking an amendment that would add statutory language that would exempt all HIV/AIDS drugs so that they do not have to have pre-authorization. So, and we would be happy to work with the committee and the committee staff to come up with the appropriate language related to that. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate those comments because I did ask about that with the idea that we probably should include them in the statute because the response from DHS was that we don't normally require pre-authorization for those because there are not that many varieties of drugs, but it would be well to do that.
Yeah. We are hoping to see statutory language there rather than rule language.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Alice Herron, Senator Morissette, and panel members. Thank you for letting me speak today. I understand that the amendment affects drastically my letter and my handouts, but I would like you to be aware of those handouts. As a family-to-family teacher for the families of mentally ill loved ones, these handouts are those that we provide to family members, and there are charts and explanations of side effects and efficacy with both the generic name of the drug as well as the brand name, if that's appropriate, and dosage levels. And it talks about some of the serious effects that I want you to be aware of, in particular, since we're just going to be speaking about antidepressants for the mentally ill today. They are there, and I've outlined them, and I've identified them on my handouts as being handouts 6.24 sub A and sub B. Those list the adverse side effects of, these are the psychotropic drugs, but the cost it addresses the cost-benefit dilemma to anyone taking medications for mental illness. And this means that the higher the cost or the adverse effects of the drug, the less perceived the benefit to the patient. And the greater the benefit, the more likely one is to tolerate the cost. And the point is to encourage compliance with taking medication. There is no single event more troubling to family members when medication is not taken or if someone becomes refractory, which means that it no longer works and they have to migrate to yet another medication. One of the comments, handouts 6.25 and 0.26 chart the tricyclics and tetracyclics developed to combat major depression. So these are antidepressant medications. And the most drastic consequence of these is the danger they pose as lethal agents of suicide. Today they are prescribed as second and third line medications used primarily for severe cases of depression. And then the other handout 6.27 charts the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, or otherwise known as the MAO, sometimes MAOIs, which are used for depression. And then handout 6.30 charts the benzodiazepines. They are no longer first-line medications, but for difficult cases, they are still prescribed. And then handouts 6.32 and 0.33 chart the first-line treatments for bipolar disorder. It is not unusual for a treatment-refractory individual with bipolar illness to be on 3 or 4 of these different medications at a time.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Do you know if these medications are on a formulary or not?
I don't, because I haven't seen them, but I wanted you to be aware so that you could ask the questions of people when they're putting these drugs on the formulary.
And just follow up, because that's what evidence-based research will be, and that takes that into account. So all of these terrible side effects that you have regarding suicide, et cetera, that will be as part of the evidence-based research that is done to put a particular drug on a formulary.
And I understand that. However, if you're taking 3 or 4 drugs and your depression is caused by many biological aspects in the brain. I'm probably not saying that medically, but the cause of the depression can be due to many different biological things happening in the brain. And so when you're medicating for it, it's not a silver bullet. It is buckshot. And as a result of buckshot, there are over 100 neurotransmitters in the brain that affect vital body functions. And as a result of the buckshot approach, vital body functions are affected, which bring on these severe side effects that also have to be managed. And even though it might be evidence-based, every patient is an individual, The other point I wanted to bring up before recognizing that we need to keep it short is last week I heard you mentioning about advertisements driving up the cost of these medications. People on the Oregon Health Plan are severely or moderately mentally ill. They are living in diminished circumstances. They are not the target of advertisements for antidepressants. And let's see, one other thing. The vast majority of the psychotropic drugs prescribed, those are the psychotropic drugs. But the point I wanted to make is that when you are a practitioner, until the parity law passed, those panels are very, very small. And if you are treating Medicaid-eligible patients, the likelihood is that you don't have an administrative staff backing you up. You probably have someone helping you bill out to, I guess, the state. And you don't have someone to call. You don't have the time to call and ask for a waiver from the formulary. And my question would be, are you going to make that time spent by those practitioners reimbursable?
We have not had testimony to that effect.
Because that time means that there's even less time to take on new patients.
Well, the only testimony we had dealing with that was a physician who said it's not a big deal. I have an assistant who makes that call and gets the waiver relatively quickly.
Well, lone practitioners who are treating the severely mentally ill, they probably don't have that staff. At least the psychiatrist that my son saw does not, that my son sees does not. So that's all. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
And thank you, Senator Morissette and the panel.
Okay. I'd like to enter into the record a letter from AARP. Rick Bennett submitted a letter. I'm going to close the public hearing. And we want to move this bill to the Ways and Means Committee, but I would rather do the amendment on the HIV first. So we'll close the public hearing and we'll come back for a work session to move this bill. And you may go before the Ways and Means Committee at some point and testify. The bill will be in the Ways and Means and we'll have a hearing there as well. As a substance committee, we're running out of time. I'm cutting bills off of the list to hear that I told people I would try to hear, and so we are under a crunch time. And we did put an amendment to remove part of the drugs, the big part, and so we're going to move the bill after we have the amendments for the HIV. So with that, the public hearing is closed. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 803. It's tough to move along.
But you know, before we do the HIV, we need to understand.
Okay. Well, let me talk to Jim Edge about that, because when I talked to him before, he didn't think it was a big deal. He said they don't do it anyway. But let me talk to Jim. Is Bates going to be here today?
Since I have to leave, do you want
Vicky was here.
Mine's
still registered. Well, okay, except Bates has to leave.
Oh, you need to. Okay, let me, I have to leave at 4.
Okay, let me do.
Vicki was just here.
For the registry?
Yeah.
For 803.
Did you already ask her? She's here for 803.
Pardon me? Is Senator Bates out here?
Where are we? No, maybe.
Okay, we're going to have a quick public hearing on Senate Bill 803. We may then go into another bill because we're having people who have to leave and people who are arriving and can't stay. Would you please summarize Senate Bill 803?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 803 requires health benefit plans issued after the effective date of the act to provide coverage for dental topical fluoride treatment for children under 18 years of age who are covered by the plan. It exempts the provision from automatic repeal. I'd like to point out to the committee that we do have a fiscal statement on Senate Bill 803.
Okay. Dr. Bates, would you please come forward?
Chair Morissette, for the record, Alan Bates, State Senator from District 3 and a physician. I've given you, hopefully by now you get a handout I've given you, and I'm not going to go over the handout with you. You can have an opportunity to read it later. My comments today will be very short and hopefully to the point. Senator Walker, who has just joined me, and I have co-sponsored this bill. Many times we find ourselves opposing things in this building. And not offering a solution to a problem. And we're trying to offer a solution to a problem here. What I oppose, at least, is fluoridation of water supplies in various cities and mandating in cities in this state. And that is a different issue, but one related to this. And I'm not going to go into why I'm opposed to that now. You'll be receiving a separate letter on that. This is a recommendation that all children have the opportunity to have the appropriate treatment with fluoride for their teeth, and in a way it's safe, and also, more importantly, in a way that is effective. We know that sealants work and that they work well. If the Healthy Children's Initiative passes as we expect it to, ultimately, then children under that initiative will, in fact, have a sealant as part of their health plan, but children not under that won't. And this is to ensure that all children in Oregon have an opportunity to get sealants for the teeth as far as fluoride is concerned to prevent cavities and caries. And that's all this bill does in a very simple manner. If we do this, then I believe the discussion about fluoridation of water becomes mute and one we don't need. So I'd be glad to take any questions you might have.
Dr. Bates, how many children currently take advantage of that? How many parents have that done for their children?
I have absolutely no idea what that number is, but I can find out for you.
Well, how much does it cost for a dentist to apply that?
When I had it done for my children, I know what that cost. I shouldn't quote it for everybody. It was about $75, if my memory is correct.
Okay, so this is an optional program for parents. That's covered by, if this passes, would be covered by insurance.
Correct. Right now, most dental programs do cover it, but a lot of children don't have dental programs through their health insurance. They're usually listed as a separate program. Generally speaking, when you have health insurance, they carve out dental and they carve out vision. And so there's usually three separate programs for most commercial insurance.
Okay. I should check with the Dental Association to find out the answer to the first question. I can do that.
And I will try to find those and help you get those.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bates, does it make sense to do baby teeth?
It generally speaking does, because you want to prevent infections in the mouth, and having good teeth of the baby teeth coming in helps the following teeth. You'll often find they'll even have extractions when you have a lot of caries in your mouth, and they'll put teeth in on a temporary basis. But I would defer that to a dentist for a complete discussion.
Can I follow?
Yes.
I have a 6-year-old. His front teeth are about that long now. I think they'll be growing just about the right size for corn on the cob this summer. So she's been saved there. But she had an X-ray and her teeth are fine. But we've had a very religious program of she brushes her teeth with a fluoride toothpaste. And from my sense, if people did that, if people did appropriate dental care themselves, wouldn't that solve a great majority of the problems?
There's no question that proper brushing, flossing on a regular basis, 2 or 3 times a day, and avoidance of those types of foods that are difficult for teeth, especially carbonated beverages with sugar in them, because the carbonation turns into acid, eats into the teeth, and it opens up bacterial infections. There's no question those things make a huge difference. But sealants also are very effective, and there's a certain amount of genetics probably involved in this, too. We seem to see some kids that have a genetic predisposition for this and some that do better. But it is a holistic program. Got a brush, eat the right foods, and sealants become available also. Now, we're not mandating sealants. We're making that option available to parents.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And Senator Bates is correct. I asked him, can we put an end to this fluoride debate, fluoridating water supplies, because I'm always going to oppose it. My community opposes it, long has since opposed it. I'm Senator Vicki Walker from District 7, by the way, Eugene, and Junction City. And, you know, I think Senator Morissette might remember years ago the city of Eugene passed a fluoridation bill. And then when the local newspaper went out and took a picture of all the fluoride sitting on the warehouse dock with skull and crossbones and poison written all over it, there was quickly a referendum passed to get rid of and repeal the law. And so they did, and we never did fluoridate the water, which is fine by me because I am one of those who just believes that you don't ingest it. It's better used topically. Let me state that this is a much better way to go than trying to force this water issue on folks. But a couple of questions have come up this morning, or this afternoon. I'm still in morning mode, but that I think are important. And one of them is the Head Start program. The Head Start program is a whole child program, and it provides a lot of services to those young children that they normally wouldn't have access to, like dental care, ophthalmology, hearing services, other kinds of social services that often are not, these children cannot get on their own if they're not in the Head Start program. They also are taught proper brushing habits, and that's one of the areas that you've talked about today, is proper brushing, proper instruction about how to take care of your teeth. I was one of those children who had lots of cavities growing up, and it was probably a combination of things. Unfortunately, I wasn't one of those babies that drug around a bottle of juice, and we're seeing children come to school in the first grade that have completely rotten teeth because they've been drinking so much juice out of their Tommy Tippy cups and their bottles, and that just erodes the teeth. So for Senator Bates and I, we felt that this was the best approach to take. Let me tell you that my children are 27 and soon to be 29. When they were younger and we went to the dentist suggested that we get sealants put on their teeth. I said, good idea, because I don't want them to have cavities. So we called the insurance company, and they were not allowed under the dental plan. And so I said, you mean you would cover the cavity? You would cover the repair of the cavity, but you won't cover the prevention of the cavity. And they said, that's right. And I said, well, then I'll just wait for the cavity. Well, of course, being a good parent, I said no, and we paid for the sealants out of our own pocket. I believe my daughter's 27, and I believe her first cavity was 2 years ago, and it broke her heart that she had a little tiny cavity. But that's how long those sealants worked on her teeth, plus she had proper brushing and proper nutrition. So they are an incredible way to save young people's teeth, especially those who are not as clear about the needs of taking care of those teeth properly. I think this is a good way to go. I also would like to see more mobile dental labs in our health clinics and our federally qualified health centers. I was at the one in Medford La Clinica.
La Clinica.
And they actually have a dental program there, a long, long, long waiting list, and one of their school-based health centers does dental care. And also one of the service organizations in the north part of the state, a Rotary Club, I believe it was, took it upon themselves to invest $100,000 in dental care for children in their community, and they would take kids up to the OHSU dental school and have them treated. So there are a lot of folks who are trying really hard to make sure our kids get adequate dental care, but we could sure head off a lot of this if they just had topical fluoride on their teeth.
Thank you very much.
And if I can add one last thing. We are trying in medicine and through legislation in this session to start moving to preventative care. We talk a lot about it. We do very little of it. This clearly falls in that category and is a step in the right direction from my point of view as far as that's concerned. We will be having, a discussion soon about fluoridation of water. And there's things we need to know about that before we go there. One is that drinking fluoridated water only works as the water passes over your teeth. There's no systemic effect to protect teeth. Two, the data is not in that it even works. We have several studies showing now that those states that have fluoridated certain parts of the state and not fluoridated water in other parts of the states, the outcome is the same as far as caries are concerned. And more concerning is a possibility of sarcoma in teenage boys as a result of fluoridation of water, a study that was done by Harvard but has not yet been confirmed. So I think this is a real step in the right direction. Allows us to work in preventative care in a way that we know is safe and effective. I would hope you consider this and pass that with a yes vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair, and I have kept my commitment to my own dentist, who is so mad at me that I won't support fluoridating water, that he said, can't you do something? And so this is the something, and I think this is a more positive approach. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much. What time did you have to leave?
I have to get to 4:10.
And you're going to be back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
After about
20
minutes.
Okay. So can we hear a bit of...
Keep going on.
Yeah, okay. Catherine Braley and John Powell, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents of the Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the testimony that was just given is... of course, accurate, and we all know that these sealants do prevent cavities. It's been the experience of all of us parents who've had that treatment available to our children, and it is very apparent to the parents whose mouths are full of fillings. And because of those fillings, sometimes break off and have to have caps. It's very expensive and no fun. In fact, if I could get rid of dentists, I would do it not for health care, but for pain management. I don't like them. Mr. Chairman and members, we Regents is headed this direction without this bill. We would ask for one amendment, however, and that is to make dental insurance primary. And understand, Regents sells dental insurance, so this isn't an amendment request that would help us to the detriment of others. It's just that this is not a very spendy benefit, and to coordinate benefits would be very difficult. So I think an amendment simply making dental insurance, if it is available, would be the primary coverage for this process before the health insurance. If dental insurance is not available, then the health insurance would pay for the treatment. It also... unfortunately for policymakers, does not end the debate over fluoride simply because, as you know, mandates on insurance companies only affect those who buy fully insured plans and would not affect self-insureds and government programs. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Questions? Kathleen.
Chair Morissette, my name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health. And within our office, we have the oral health program. I just wanted to say a few words and do not actually have a prepared testimony for you today. The office actually is neutral on this bill for a couple of different issues. Number one, while it clearly supports our oral health program's efforts to increase access for at-risk children, the evidence to date is that this works most effectively in early childhood, which is 0 to 5. So topical fluoride treatments work with early children and their primary teeth. There was a little bit of discussion about sealants by the previous speakers, and dental sealants is actually an entirely different approach. It's a very effective approach that you apply to your molars when they come in at about third or fourth grade, and it essentially applies a coating to the molars. It's also an evidence-based practice and is a highly recommended practice because the majority of dental decay in children actually occurs in the molars. So I just want to clarify, this bill only speaks to topical fluoride treatments, and the department is recommending that it actually be limited to early childhood, which is 0 to 5, for which there is evidence. And while it's a promising practice in older children, we haven't actually seen that demonstrated. We prefer that there was more of a focus on dental sealants. The only other comment I think that I would make briefly is that while we consider this as an important adjunct to oral health care, we actually do not see it as a replacement for the fluoridation issue, and we'll look forward to the opportunity to discuss that further with this committee.
So this is not a sealant.
Chair Morissette and committee, no, this is for topical fluoride treatments. So again, for the potentially considering an amendment for 0 to 5, it would be very appropriate and reflective of the literature that it's a best practice for early children, early childhood.
Thank you.
And just a question, how much topical fluoride costs? Evidently around $75, according to the senator from Ashland. How much does a sealant cost?
Chair Morissette and Senator Sanderson, I unfortunately don't have that information in my head, but I'll have it to the committee shortly, and we'll double-check our numbers on that. I apologize.
Maybe.
Well, we're going to have a dentist up here in a minute. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Margie Hoffman, Oregon Dental Association.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. I want to clarify, my name is Margie Hoffman. I represent the Oregon Dental Association. However, I'm their lobbyist. I am not a dentist. So I will try to answer any questions that you may have in regards to best dental practices, but may need to circle back with information. We are here to testify in support of SB 803, but echo the concerns that were raised by both the Office of Oral Health and Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. This bill is a step in the right direction to provide preventative dental care to Oregon's children, which is a huge at-risk population. However, it does not provide comprehensive dental care or comprehensive preventative dental treatment to all of Oregon's children and seniors and adults. So we look forward to coming back to work with you on the fluoridation bill as well. According to the Department of Human Services in Oregon, over 60% of children between 6 and 8 have dental caries or tooth decay. This can lead to severe tooth decay. 16% of Oregonians over the age of 60 have no teeth at all because of severe tooth decay that is preventable. This severe tooth decay can lead, obviously, to loss of teeth, but can also lead to further systemic diseases like heart disease. So, again, just want to say we appreciate the efforts of Senator Bates and Senator Walker for moving this legislation forward. We believe this is a good first step, but is not the only step that we need to take to provide preventative care for Oregonians. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Elise Brown, Lisa Trussell, would you come up, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Elise Brown representing AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, which has 1,300 members across the country and insuring about 200 million Americans. And it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon to weigh in on such an important issue. As a parent myself of two young kids, I certainly understand the importance of supporting preventive measures, as I have kids now who don't have good mouths, so completely understand that. But also, as a member of the healthcare industry, it's my responsibility to point out to this committee that it does not come without a price. As John Powell just stated, some of the health plans in Oregon do not offer dental insurance. So for those plans, this would be a new mandate. And it also gives me the opportunity just to remind the committee that 39 mandates have already been introduced in this legislative session. And when you add those up incrementally, as John said, this one is not a big cost driver, but it does incrementally add costs, and particularly when you look at what Oregon's already got on the mandate list. So it's for that reason that I wanted to come forward and just express our concerns and opposition to this, as it would be a new cost for health insurance plans in Oregon and for the insurance buying public, which I think Lisa Trussell can attest to.
Lisa? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm here also in opposition to Senate Bill 803. And I concur with the comments that Ms. Brown made. The volume of new mandates, and we've talked a lot this session about prioritizing healthcare and the delivery system. It would be very helpful for purchasers if we could prioritize of those 39 mandates, which are in several different committees, which are the ones that are the most important, because everything that you add on adds on to the cost of the insurance. And we've already seen, and this bill particularly targets children under the age of 18, and what we saw during the recession was that employees and employers, for that matter, when they're facing higher costs of health insurance, the coinsurance goes up on the employee's part, and in some cases they'll drop their dependent coverage because at some point it becomes cost prohibitive for the employee to meet their share of the premium on that. So I would just caution you to be aware of what the potential universe for new mandates are, and try to within your own processes prioritize which ones are more deserving to go forward at this point, as opposed to waiting and looking at another avenue for them.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing, and there has been some discussion on amendments, and I want to go back and talk to the sponsors of the bill one more time before we move this. Okay. Or you want to wait for 873, right?
No, I'd like to do.
Okay. We're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 873. And Senator Montes Anderson will testify.
Senate Bill 873 requires the Department of Human Services to establish a statewide registry to obtain information on birth abnormalities and poor pregnancy outcomes, develop strategies for reducing incidences of birth defects, provide parents and guardians with prevention information, and refer parents and guardians to appropriate services. The committee does have before them a -1 amendment. The -1 amendment substitutes fetal wasting with stillbirth in the definition of poor pregnancy outcomes. And also, due to a drafting error, it removes a requirement that hospitals must maintain records for 6 years and replaces this with a rule that would allow DHS to require hospitals to provide records to the registry of all patients born with birth abnormalities and experiencing poor pregnancy outcomes.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Morissette, members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Montes-Anderson from Senate District 25, Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview, and I am delighted to be here in support of Senate Bill 873. The Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance got together, and we asked the March of Dimes, what would you like to bring to the legislature? And they said that a registry, a birth defects registry is an extremely important issue. Oregon is only one of five states that does not have a birth defects registry. It's important for you to know that one in ten babies in Oregon are born prematurely, and that one in 33 babies in Oregon is born with a birth defect. So birth defects are the leading cause of infant mortality in the United States. Surveillance is absolutely necessary to track the incidence of birth defects and identify communities and populations at higher risk. Basically, state-based surveillance systems help health officials evaluate needs, deliver services, and implement and evaluate prevention programs. Research into the cause of birth defects is a critical step in developing cost-effective strategies to prevent them. Do you have other people to testify? So I will leave it at that and let March of Dimes people come forward and give more testimony.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chair. Senator Montes-Anderson, I would just point out that since 21 members of the Senate and 32 members of the House are co-sponsors of the bill, this may have a reasonable chance of passage.
I know. We worked really hard on getting those signatures.
Well, I think there are several amendments that we have to deal with. No, I'm kidding.
I don't want to. I'm sick of amendments. All right.
Joanne Rogovoy, Jennifer Horner. Did you want to leave now? You may if you want. And Richard.
Chairman Morissette and committee members, my name is Joanne Rogovoy, and I'm the State Program Director for the March of Dimes. The mission of the March of Dimes is to improve the health of babies by preventing birth defects, preterm birth, and infant mortality. And Senator Montes-Anderson covered most of our critical points. I just wanted to say a few things, highlight a few things, that the March of Dimes believes that states play a critical role in preventing birth defects by maintaining registries. To look at the incidence of birth defects, where they're occurring, what types of birth defects are occurring, if there's populations that are at increased risk, and it's more than data collection. That's important, but it's also a means to investigate if there's clusters of birth defects or if there's some type of trend going on. Senator Montes-Anderson said that we were one of five states without a birth defects monitoring system. We're now one of four states. We are, along with Idaho, Wyoming, and South Dakota, the only states that do not have any type of a birth defects monitoring or registry system. The District of Columbia and Puerto Rico also monitor birth defects. Again, one in 33 babies are born with a birth defect, and it's one in five infant deaths are due to a birth defect. The system, a registry system, has many useful purposes. It could provide a baseline of numbers of birth defects in the state, which we do not have currently. It can identify trends, which I mentioned. It can identify children with a birth defect who are in need of services and are not getting them. And it can refer families appropriately to services. It can also provide a means to evaluate service utilization. It can provide a means to plan for services where particular conditions are occurring in higher frequencies. And it's a way to initiate prevention programs and provide public health with a means to evaluate prevention programs. With that said, again, the March of Dimes wholeheartedly supports Senate Bill 873 to establish a birth defects registry.
Thank you. Senator Morissette and committee members, I'm Richard Lowenson. I'm a physician. I'm a perinatologist. I've practiced at OHSU for 20 years, taking care of high-risk pregnancies, and I'm the chair of the Health Professionals Advisory Committee for the March of Dimes. And I'd like to urge you to help us allow Oregon to join the rest of the United States with having a birth registry. Not all birth defects are apparent at birth. To give you a few examples, fetal alcohol syndrome, part of the definition involves mental retardation, which is obviously impossible for us to diagnose at birth. Many heart defects don't show up at all for up to a week after birth. Cerebral palsy may take months or years to make an accurate diagnosis. So just relying on our existing system where we report defects apparent to us at birth is really inadequate to identify what our problems are in the state. Birth defects can act like a canary in a coal mine and help us to identify situations that are developing, like environmental problems. A number of years back, we had a case where we saw three very young women present with children with the same birth defect within a few weeks of each other. They were all babies with gastroschisis, which is a condition where the skin doesn't close across the abdomen and the intestines develop outside. The thing that concerned us was that one of these women came from Hood River, one came from Klamath Falls, one came from Corvallis. All three of them were women who were working in the fields, and we were concerned that this might represent an insecticide exposure. The problem was that we contacted the health department immediately. No one knew what our baseline incidence in Oregon was of this particular birth defect or whether this represented a sudden increase or not. And there was no way to look and see if there was any correlation with young women working in the fields. And we just had no place to go with this data at that point. A situation where we got accurate numbers of specific birth defects in the state would help us to respond more appropriately in a situation like that. As you know, it's hard to ask for money to deal with any situation if you don't have numbers to back up your requests. Without this data, I don't think any of us can help to evaluate competing requests for support. In this case, the dollars are really a bargain. The existing system in the state is there's a family and child module in the family net, which is part of the health department. There's already in existence because of that a database that links birth certificate data, newborn dried blood screening, home visit developmental screening, WIC nutrition screening, and newborn hearing screening. The extra dollars and personnel that this would require to add post-birth diagnosis for inherited or congenital disease is not a big leap. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Morissette and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Jennifer Horner. I reside in Portland, and I'm here as a parent. I'm here today to ask your support for Senate Bill 873. 8 years ago this month, my son Henry died when he was just 2 weeks old. His death was caused by a congenital anomaly or a birth defect called a diaphragmatic hernia. That is when the diaphragm does not close and organs shift from the abdomen into the chest and significantly compromise lung growth and development. After two major surgeries and 2 weeks in a neonatal intensive care unit, Henry died from these complications. Our son's birth defect was detected at 20 weeks gestation by ultrasound, and due to those complications related to his condition, I was placed on bed rest for 9 weeks to prevent delivering too early and to give him the strongest start possible. During this time, we were desperate for information and for understanding. For the last 8 years, my family and I have struggled with the grief of losing a child too soon and searched for an understanding as to why this happened. So I'm here today to ask your support for Senate Bill 873. Having a birth defects registry or monitoring system that allows for tracking these anomalies could provide necessary information to those seeking to answer the questions of why. A registry could allow for tracking trends, aid in targeting prevention programs, and in helping families access services. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Sandy Trunick and Kathleen Brady. Bradley.
Chair Morissette and committee, thank you very much. This is Catherine Bradley, Administrator for the Office of Family Health, and I am speaking in regards to Senate Bill 873, which establishes a congenital birth abnormality registry, and I believe you have our testimony. I won't go through the specifics of the testimony because much of it has been covered. I do want to touch base on a couple of quick issues. Because of the many benefits, DHS does support 873 in concept. Over the past 5 years, the Public Health Division has attempted to secure federal grant funds from the Centers for Disease Control to create a registry. That is traditionally the way that's been done in the majority of the other states. Three times we have actually been approved for funding, but we haven't received the funding. And the reason is because the federal government has now made it quite clear that the funding that they have is being used with existing registries. So it really is dependent now on the state of Oregon to make the determination that it wants to fund a birth registry because we'll no longer be able to receive federal funding. It's also important to note that Senate Bill 873 does not appropriate funds currently. We have put an estimate of somewhere in the neighborhood of $450,000 for the biennium for the establishment of this. We'd have to purchase some software, and there would be some initial and ongoing staff costs, and it's not currently in the governor's recommended budget. We do have a comment on the amendment once it's proposed with some potentially broadening language that Senator Moniz Anderson might want to take into consideration. But DHS does support all families in Oregon, especially those with special health care needs and disabilities. We appreciate the use of using language that is respectful in referring to our congenital and birth abnormalities registry concept, and we are very supportive in intent of 873. Thank you very much, and I certainly have any questions? Can I answer any questions?
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Since it would have a price tag of $450,000, I assume that this would need to go to Ways and Means, or we would need a fiscal on it.
Yeah, the fiscal hasn't been issued yet, ma'am.
No, it was requested, but we haven't done it.
Yeah. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I fully understanding that. That's, you know, that can be something Ways and Means can deal with. I'd like to get it established, and the funding is another issue, clearly, but I would hate to see the program not go in for lack of funding. We can fight that in the appropriate. I mean, that'd just be my suggestion at this point.
I don't know if we have an alternative.
It doesn't have a referral.
My name is Judy Turk. I live in Oloa, and I'm here as a parent and a nurse and a grandma. My daughter was born 31 years ago with esophageal atresia, and like the previous lady who testified, I, too, was frantically looking around for help during her surgeries and found no one. And it was very discouraging, and I was told by several doctors that her birth anomaly was one in a million. So I certainly support the concept and the idea of trying to establish a birth defect registry here in Oregon, and I thank you very much for introducing this bill. My comments have pretty much been covered by other people. I would like to echo the concerns about looking for birth defects after the baby goes home from the hospital, because so many babies don't manifest their problems until later in life. And so I think there needs to be a mechanism to collect data on birth defects from practitioners in the field, docs, therapists, schools, as well as hospitals. And I think it's entirely appropriate, and I would encourage it to be housed in the health division, because they've already been through the important kinds of confidentiality issues that will need to be addressed with a birth defects registry. And finally, I'd like to reiterate that I really think an advisory committee is important to this particular project, and would like to encourage the committee to consider it as a requisite rather than as a might do. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Okay, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 873.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 873.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 873. Any discussion, objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, just a brief discussion here before we make the next motion. To what I said just a minute ago, and I guess I would look at things we have done in this assembly previous. For example, I would bring up the pesticide reporting system that we put in statute 2 years before we actually funded it. And so it would not be unprecedented to do that. I think of all of the potential registries or data collections that are before this assembly, this session, this is probably the best one of the bunch. I truly believe that, because this can get to some real cause and effect. I truly believe that. I would hate to see the creation of the registry fall subject to the vagaries of the Ways and Means Committee, because quite often some very good bills get lost down there. So because this bill has no subsequent referral currently, if it would be the pleasure of the committee, I would like to make the motion just to move the bill to before the Senate. Just my thoughts, Mr. Chair.
Is that a motion?
No, I just wanted to see if...
When we, Mr. Chair, yes. when we do that, does that mean that DHS, without money, would have to implement this?
Well,
there have been several bills introduced that were funds available bills, and I imagine that, you know, there is precedent for that. Some of them state funds available, some of them just imply funds available.
I think that this could be addressed on the House side.
That's well, yes. If it's a pleasure of the committee, I'll move it to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I think that it's a good idea to move it to the floor. Mm-hmm. And I think if it looks like it's not going to be fixed, then I think that the legislature should... take a look. I serve on Ways and Means. I would certainly be taking a look at the DHS budget when it comes to full Ways and Means to see how that couldn't be made possible.
Okay. Catherine, did you have any comments?
Actually, I'll defer to Patty, sir.
Uh-oh.
Hi, for the record, I'm Patricia O'Sullivan, DHS. So let me make sure I have this straight. You want to send the bill. It has a $450,000 fiscal impact for the department, and you'd like to send it straight to the floor, not to Ways and Means, but you won't object if we take care of the referral to Ways and Means on the House side?
Mr. Chair, may I? I think I would like... And correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Moss Anderson, I would like for a policy committee on the House side to have the discussion, just because it broadens the base of people. I mean, obviously, with the sponsorship list, a lot of people are supportive of it, but I think that would increase its likelihood if it took that path.
Senator Cruz, I don't know how anybody else like LFO and folks like that are going to feel, feel about this. But as far as the department's concerned, we can take care. We will have a referral to Ways and Means. I'll have to chase after that, because we can't have a bill out there with no funding, with people's expectation that we carry out the bill and implement the bill, whether it says with funding available or not. We have a lot of laws on the books that say if funding's available, some of those programs we do anyway and some we don't do, and it's just more laws out there that for no reason. So if your intention is for this bill to get vetted on the House side and for it to go through and get funded and be implemented, then we'll make sure that there's a referral to Ways and Means from the House committee.
Oh.
We can do that.
Okay. Did you hear that?
Yes.
Wait a minute. Did you hear what she just said?
No.
Say it again.
Okay, sorry.
I was writing notes.
It was really long.
Because I have to go.
No, read the last part.
What I said was there's a lot of laws that get passed, and there's no funding. not a lot, but it says, you know, sort of within available funding or whatever the little catchphrase is. And the problem with that, of course, is that then we come back to you guys and e-board and say we're short of money because we have to do all these things that aren't funded. If your intention is that this get vetted on the House side and that it get funded and that we actually implement this bill, then I don't have any objection, the department doesn't have any objection, to moving it to the House to be vetted, but we're going to try to get, obviously, a referral out of the House committee to Ways and Means, which means that you'll have to vote twice on the Senate floor for it.
What if we...
Or maybe not. I'm not sure how that works.
Ms. Chair, I guess the issue is, but at least the House gets to hear it. If we send it to Ways and Means, it does not necessarily ever get to a committee in the House.
Well, Senator Cruz, I'll acquiesce to the committee, whatever you want to do. I don't prefer that it be done that way, but if that's the way you do it, I just want you to know that we're going to have to insist somewhere along the way that it go meet our budget up and either get funded or the bill not be passed.
Okay. We did pass a bill for emergency management that was funded later, but it did say funds available, and funding did become available, and the bill was... And that was with the understanding that there was not money to do it at the time. That was for the tsunami warning system, and it was funded. Now, is there a problem? I think you've already stated a problem with funds available. It kind of mucks things up.
Senator Moore said, the legislature has, in all their wisdom, passed bills like this before, and we have some on the books that have never been funded. Like, I believe there's a diabetes registry. It's never been funded. It's on the books. So it just sits out there as law, and nothing ever happens to it. So the chances of it getting put in our budget and funded, you may believe, are better with it actually in law. I don't know whether that's true or not in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. O'Sullivan has brought up a good point about expectations. Mm-hmm. I would like to support her in that because I do think that it rises to a level that people expect something to happen.
Maybe if we amended it to subject to availability of funds, but
let's have this discussion. Senator Mona Sanderson said she wanted to wait. She wrote me a note before she left.
Okay. Well, if we wait, it will go to Ways and Means, so we could probably just. I mean, I think that's a certainty, don't you think?
It will go to Ways and Means unless we decide we are going to do, as Ms. O'Sullivan said, we could do in our ultimate wisdom is send it to the floor. It would end up in the House for consideration and then be sent to Ways and Means, but there would be some momentum going to the House. And again, with as many people that signed on to the bill, I don't have a problem if you would like to make that motion and if we have the support for it, but I don't know if Senator Berger is.
Can you put it away or what?
Wait until Senator Munson's comes back or wait for another day?
No,
for another day.
For another day.
Or do you want to move?
You want to move it to the floor of the House, send it, pass it, send it to the House, and let them deal with it.
I think that's a good plan.
Okay, good.
I think that's a good plan.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 873 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
This is so much fun.
Senator Cruz moves 873 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Excuse.
Senator Ronald Anderson?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morrison?
Aye. The bill will go to the floor of the Senate, and Senator Mona Sanderson will carry the bill. Okay.
See how simple that was?
Yes, indeed. Okay. now, let's see. We're going to have a couple more bills to hear. I'm not sure we're going to pass either one of them off, but we can hear
okay.
them. Senate Bill 768. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 768.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 768 establishes the Family Caregiver Support Advisory Board and specifies composition, structure, and criterion for membership. It allows people providing in-home care without compensation to senior or disabled relatives to receive a credit of up to $500 against state taxes for expenses related to care, training, and supplies.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bob Lawrence, Lucy Morgan, and Barbara Nelson. Would you come up, please? Here's not a fiscal, it's just a tax credit.
Well, no, there is, I think. That's a tax credit, isn't it?
Is there a fiscal?
Senator Morris said, if I let out a scream, it's because I have a kidney stone that's going down.
Ooh.
Oh.
But it has nothing to do with your...
Oh, thank God. I'm not responsible for that.
Ouch.
Thank you very much for this chance to have a hearing on this really important bill. Actually, before I preface that, I want to introduce Barbara Nelson on my left, who was a administrator of the McMinnville Adult Senior Center for 17 years. And on my right is Lucy Morgan, who's a new member of the Governor's Commission. And she's here in behest of Kay Kirkbride. I wish Kay Kirkbride could have been here because when she talks about respite care and stuff like that, she really knows it from the heart. But she is doing her training today. So... on respite care. She's really committed to it. This is the second phase of following up on this. There was Dr. Davis will report on this bill that started in 1991, and now we're here back again. So, as you know, Senator Morris said, we have the Governor's Commission on Senior Services with the Area Agency on Aging. Excuse me. Did I introduce myself?
Do it again,
Bob. I think we're all nervous. So
go ahead.
I'm Robert Lawrence, and I'm a resident of Clackamas County. This year, I'm the legislative coordinator for the commission and also the chair of the legislative committee, which gives me a chance to do things quicker. When we did our community forums with the Area Agency on Aging and with senior and people with disability, one thing emerged quite clearly to us was that the hidden need of family caregivers. Every time I've ever talked to anybody about this particular subject, people will say, yes, I know what you're talking about. I had my mother and dad and things like this. So this became a very surfaced as one of the critical issues for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. We have a lot of advocates here who will speak to the bill in support. AARP was not able to make it because of a conflict, but they gave me the authorization to say that they are in support of this bill.
Bob, just a minute. We have the votes to move this bill to revenue.
Okay.
Would you, and then you would get a hearing in revenue.
Okay.
Is that okay? Did anyone travel long distances?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah. I mean, this bill's tracked to go from here to revenue okay. to Ways and Means.
So we don't have to sell you on it.
No.
Mr. Chair, we're sold.
You're sold.
Yeah. Okay.
That was easy.
Well, sometimes if you keep talking, it becomes harder.
Unsold. Gotcha.
As long as this is recognition that this is part of our future planning. Mm-hmm. All of the commission work that we're doing.
Okay, excuse me. I don't want to cut you off, though. So please
okay,
go ahead and because...
You want us to go ahead or just...
Well, abbreviate it, and then we will move it. Yeah, but just because I know you've put in a lot of work on this, and so just give us the abbreviated
well,
version.
I'm done, and Barbara has a very short testimony, and
Do you want me to go next?
Yeah.
Please forgive me, since I am a stand-in, I do need to read a little bit of...
Give us, introduce yourself.
I'm Lucy Morgan, and I am a new member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I live here in Salem. In the State of the States report developed by the National Caregiver Alliance, October of 2006, it estimated Oregon informal caregivers provide $385 million caregiving hours, and that the value of that caregiving is over $3.8 billion per year. And that's a tremendous resource to us and a savings of public funding in the long-term care system. Also, to quote a report titled Caregiving in the United States by the National Alliance for Caregiving and the AARP in April of 2004, which was funded by MetLife Foundation, caregivers report that the most frequently unmet needs are finding time for themselves, 35%, managing emotional and physical stress, 29%, and balancing work and family responsibilities, 29%. And the respite care would help with those, avoid them or lessen them. And this has been documented in publications in International Journal of Geriatric Psychology of 1997 and the International Journal of Gerontology 1993. That concludes what I say.
As you have heard, were unpaid family caregivers to cease providing this care, the enormous burden placed on our health care system would be crippling. Unfortunately, the family support system is often frayed, and caregivers are lacking in training, resulting in poor care or placement in an institution setting longer before necessary. To end it, we know that there are several additional people here that like to testify, so we will complete our testimony. There is one last amendment needed to this bill, however. When we asked the Legislative Council to draft the bill, we had proposed that the credit would only be available to caregivers whose household incomes were below $60,000. So that the bill would benefit those who need it the most. Unfortunately, that threshold was omitted from the bill by the council. We would like to have that language included in this bill. That concludes my, I summed that up.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Morrison.
I think we can do that in Revenue Committee.
Yes. That's what I thought. I just wanted to bring it to your attention.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing. No. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 768 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 768 be referred to the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moved that 768 be referred to Senate Finance and Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that I think when families participate in the caregiving, there is a sweetness there that is missed if people are treated by home health or strangers or institutionals or whatever. And I think that regardless of the training level or regardless of some of the things that maybe have to be learned or the stress level, I think that for both the patient and the family, it is very, very rewarding.
Yes, it is.
That's true.
Thank you.
Yeah. It seems to historically been the federal government has viewed relative care as a system that people will game, and so they've had significant problems with it. I'm glad to see this. We also have legislation this session that's dealing with relative foster care for kids who were removed from their home, and kind of in the same context here, as that's where the best care probably is, and families shouldn't be penalized for providing the care. So and I think the amendment would probably be appropriate, but Senator Deckert can deal with that in his committee.
Okay. Before we call for the question, I would like to enter into the testimony voted by Co-Parmenter, Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and Jim Davis, Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens. So we will enter that into the record. Motion.
Motion.
Oh, we had the motion. Okay. Would you call the roll, please? Excused. Excused.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Senate Bill 768 will move to the Revenue Committee. Okay. One more bill. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 857. Grover Simmons, would you come up?
No, we did not. Okay. There are going to be snow amendments coming back. We'll have one and all.
Okay,
one,
so. We have a couple of DHS people here. Grover, do you want to give it your best shot before I bring DHS up?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Okay.
And all the others?
Oh!
Room full of them. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. I appreciate your scheduling this particular bill. The bill deals with the problem of substantiated complaints in adult foster homes. And it was triggered by a couple of cases, which, if I can explain the cases, I believe will help understand what the bill is trying to accomplish. The first case deals with a lady, a 96-year young lady, who's being cared for in an adult foster home in Eastern Oregon, in La Grande. And the second case occurred in the town of Cove, also in Eastern Oregon. The lady in La Grande has a prepaid telephone card, and her daughter instructed the staff at the foster home to advise her whenever the minutes on the telephone card got down to below 100 minutes left. So that was easy to keep track of because the MCI always advises you when you make a long-distance call or a call against a prepaid card how many minutes you have left. So it was not a task to keep track of where they were. So one time the provider advised the daughter that the minutes had been reduced below 100. They were pretty low. And the daughter says, well, how can that be? I just added money to the prepaid card. And the daughter didn't think too much more about the situation. But on the other hand, the provider, the owner, operator, and the adult foster home provider was very concerned about the factual situation. So she started contacting the telephone company, MCI, and was able to get a good bit of information about the usage of that card, the date that phone calls were made, the time of day that they were made, and the location of those calls. So it turns out that many of the calls were made late at night to and from the jail. Senators had an appropriate reaction. That's exactly right. That's an amazing fact. Here is a situation going on involving a jail in La Grande. So the provider had all of this documented information from the telephone company. She matched that with her records of when certain staff people were on duty, the time they were on duty, and the dates and everything. And she became absolutely convinced that a certain provider, substitute caregiver, had misappropriated that telephone number. The card was left in a drawer right under a lamp, so it was never missing, but the number had been misappropriated. So whenever this lady wanted to make a phone call, the staff would dial the number and put in the code number and then give the telephone to the lady, the 96-year-old lady, and that's the way it worked satisfactorily for a long, long while. So the provider confronted the substitute caregiver and discharged her right on the spot. And then she called the senior services office in La Grande and reported the incident. An investigator came out to the home to interview the people, to interview the provider and the elderly resident. And then issued a substantiated complaint against the provider, which goes on the public record against that home. And that's the issue that we are most concerned about. It punishes the provider, and it damages the business. That public record is available, as all of you know. Whenever you're looking for a place to put one of your residents or one of your relatives, etc., so you go to the public record and you see what's available and so forth. What is the public's comments about that home? So the department says, oh, Grover, don't worry, those records are not read. Well, they are read, and we take this as a serious situation. They are read, they are used by the public, and so dismissing it out of hand, I think, is not very appropriate. Now, the discharged substitute caregiver refused to even meet with the department's investigator. She was long gone. And she remained on the approved list of caregivers in that community until I was able to get that cleaned up, thanks to the department cooperating, to take her off the approved list of the list of approved caregivers in that community. But that took a little special doing. The second case deals with drugs. A substitute caregiver stole Vicodin, which was medication for one of the residents in the second home. Took the narcotic, and when confronted by the adult foster home provider, admitted stealing the drugs. She was terminated on the spot, and so forth. Unfortunately, she remains on the list of approved people to work in long-term care. As of this morning, I made the call, and as of this morning, I was told that she remains on the list of people approved to work in long-term care, even though she was terminated for stealing narcotics. I'd like to put in a request, to put in the record, if you would, Mr. Chairman, a letter from the daughter of the in the first case, 96-year-old lady.
Excuse me. Yeah. You're saying that the provider is being punished. She is not on the approved list.
No, the provider was the home, and the provider wound up with a substantiated complaint against the home.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's the adverse effect on the business.
Well, are they on an approved list?
There's a list in the community of in-home of people who are able to work in long-term care, in-home care, foster homes, and perhaps other locations as well. And that list is used by the adult foster home community to find substitute caregivers, for example. So this lady was still on that list as of today. So
the one who perpetrated the offense was on an approved list?
Correct. Actually, that's correct.
But are you saying, though, that the home had a black mark against it?
Yes.
And the provider did not? I mean, the woman who was fired?
Did not. I'm advised that's the way the case turned out. The home has a substantiated complaint on the public record
against the home.
Against the home. And the caregiver the substitute caregiver, nothing happened there.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I want to apologize to the people in the audience. I must leave,
okay,
and,
okay.
And I would not do this if it were
well,
not.
Well, we'll bring this back.
All right.
Okay. Now, Grover, you and I are alone here. I'm alone here.
Well, not Mr. Chairman, not quite.
Well, I know I think all of them are taking issue with what you're saying.
For about 20-some years, that's always been the case. We're never
okay.
alone when we talk about adult foster homes
okay.
and the problems we have.
Now, what I would like to do when you finish is bring someone up from DHS, whoever they want to send up, Mary Gear, perhaps, or Morgan Brody, or... Even is I don't see Meredith. Oh, there she is. Okay, you can come up and also see where we, because I think there's what I understand there is a reconcilable difference in of opinion. I think not irreconcilable. I think from what I understand that it may be fixed. I think. So do you want to continue and? For a few minutes, and I'll bring someone else up that they can.
I'll just conclude, Mr. Chairman. The daughter of the elderly resident lady that we've been referring to has written a letter,
mm-hmm.
and I asked her if I could have it entered in the record,
yeah.
and it's a part of the testimony, it's the first letter. She writes eloquently, and it explains the case perhaps as well, better than I. Also, a copy of the substantiated complaint
okay.
is a part of this record that I have given to the committee.
Okay.
And it has one sentence that is of interest. The provider, this is what the investigator concluded.
Mm-hmm.
The provider failed to provide a safe and secure environment. Resulting in the RV, I presume that means victim, being financially exploited by a caregiver. So she failed to provide a safe and secure environment, which resulted in the exploitation of this 96-year-old lady. It's pretty tough to reach that conclusion, but that's what the investigator said. Well, then you turn to the statute itself, dealing with the ability to revoke a license, if you'll believe this, without a hearing where there is exploitation. So all of a sudden it gets to be pretty serious. It cannot be dismissed as, well, you know, nobody reads the record or don't get upset or anything like that. When you can have your license revoked, and according to ORS 443.745, on the grounds of exploitation without a hearing. It's not a good result. So, lastly, there is a page in here from Multnomah County, which I would just like to read one sentence of it. Operators, resident managers, and caregivers, and any person with reasonable cause to believe that abuse, neglect, or exploitation has taken place in an adult care home shall immediately make a report to Adult Protective Services or a law enforcement agency. So the state statutes are less clear. Multnomah County statute, I just read that, is clear as all outdoors. You're obligated and duty-bound to report an incident like this, which these providers did in Eastern Oregon, even though they are under the state rules. But I checked and double-checked, and the providers over there believe and practice that they have to report. So it's not something that that's just you do or you don't. They believe they have to report, and they do report whenever an incident of this sort happens, and they wind up with a substantiated complaint against the home. And it adversely affects their business, and then that's not a good result, and we urgently request relief. And that's my testimony, and thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I like it.
Yeah, well, just the two of us.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have introduced this to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, stay right there, please.
Okay,
Mary Gear and Meredith. Welcome back. Mary.
Hi.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Mary Gere. I'm the administrator of the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care for Seniors and People with Disabilities in the Department of Human Services. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. Senator Morsett, I heard you real clearly earlier when you said that the more we talk, the harder it gets for us, so I'm going to keep this real short. I'm here on behalf of the department to oppose the bill as written. There are a number of reasons for that. My office is charged with the responsibility for licensing adult foster homes. There are over 4,000 in the state that serve seniors, people with disabilities, and people with developmental disabilities. We also oversee the Adult Protective Services Program. Our concerns are that this bill weakens a provider's responsibility to be proactive in preventing situations where neglect and abuse may occur. What this bill does is it addresses a situation where abuse or neglect or potential for abuse or neglect has already occurred and ignores the situation where a provider has an obligation up front to do appropriate screening, interviewing, training, supervision, and ongoing training of their caregivers. And so it weakens, we believe, the oversight and upfront actions that a provider needs to take in order to assure that residents in an adult foster home or in any setting are safe from abuse or neglect or the potential for abuse and neglect. We also believe that there's potential that residents would not be protected. The bill provides that a provider can reassign a staff person in a situation where there's been potential for abuse and neglect, which may put other residents or other clients at risk for abuse and neglect and not protect them. And then there are some words in the bill, specifically disciplinary action, reasonable time with intent, that are broad, leave a lot of room for interpretation, and might make it difficult for us. I would ask for the opportunity to speak with Mr. Simmons to see if there's some resolution we can come to. Clearly, he brings up a very difficult issue, which is that when in a situation where we've substantiated abuse, the provider may have a black mark, as you say, on their record, but the caregiver may not. And certainly we'd like the opportunity to look at strengthening our ability to take enforcement action or some kind of action against a caregiver, a specific caregiver who's been subject to a substantiated allegation of abuse and neglect. I would simply mention that in those situations, it would make the department's case much stronger if we were able to substantiate the situation of abuse and neglect, so then to take it forward and take some action against the caregiver as well. So thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, a couple of things. The example that Mr. Simmons gave, the first example where the woman was using the cell phone and she was immediately dismissed, do you follow through? Now, was that, okay, first of all, was that ever reported to you, I wonder? That particular instance, did you receive a complaint from the person who runs the home?
Senator Morris, that I would need to check in and ensure of that. The fact that Mr. Simmons said an investigator did the investigation would indicate that that had occurred.
So that would be the first thing that they would do. And now, do you have any... I think he also said that maybe he didn't say that that person was currently employed somewhere else and that there was no sanctions against that particular person, which raises a question. Do you have the authority to follow the person even though they quit a job and restrict their licensure if necessary for future employment? Do you have that opportunity?
Senator Morris, that the answer to that is a bit complicated, because whether a caregiver is licensed or certified or regulated in any way varies by the setting that they're in. Okay. And I would need to specifically look at adult foster homes.
Okay.
Essentially, what we're doing is we're holding the provider, the adult foster home owner and operator, responsible for the conduct of their employees.
Okay. And what about their appeal, the appeal process, in terms of, I believe he also said that a person could lose their license, perhaps, without appeal?
Without a hearing.
Without a hearing.
Senator Morris, that when the department takes an action to revoke a license, that's typically based on a series of substantiated complaints where there's been significant issues. And because it's an adverse action against a provider, the provider would have the opportunity to appeal that.
What about the opportunity to appeal any negative sanctions on the adult foster home, which you say is responsible for the action of their employees, if they felt that they were really not at fault and should not be sanctioned, do they have an opportunity to appeal?
Certainly. If we took adverse action against a provider, for example, issued a civil penalty fine, that provider would have the opportunity to appeal that.
Okay. If the provider, though, has noted on their public record that they had a negative sanction against them, would the appeal eliminate that negative public sanction? So it would not be on their record if someone was looking for a place to put their loved one and they looked through and they saw, oh, well, here's a provider that had a complaint against it, not knowing what the complaint is. So do they have an opportunity to remove that?
Whether it was removed or not would depend on the outcome of the hearing.
Okay.
If the complaint was substantiated, then it would remain in the record.
Okay. If the complaint against the worker was substantiated, that would reflect against the provider. Is that right, currently?
Well, when we go into, Senator Morissette, when we go into do an investigation, we look at what happened in a global sense.
Okay.
That means we would look at the actions of the provider as well as the actions of any individual caregivers, as well as the action of the resident and the family, if that's relevant.
In any circumstance, would the owner, the operator of the home, be held whole harmless for the action of a worker if the worker did something that you found was absolutely not the fault of the provider? Would that ever be recorded as such, or is it just a policy that you hold the owner of the home responsible, period?
In a situation where the license holder is the adult foster home operator and we have responsibility for regulating that license, that's our only avenue.
Your only avenue.
Is through the license.
I understand. And then the purpose of this bill is to find a different avenue. But therein lies the conflict. Meredith, could you enlighten us, please?
Oh. I would not pretend to do that, Mr. Chair. My name is Meredith Cote, and I am the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And the Long-Term Care Ombudsman program investigates and resolves complaints of residents. We monitor the long-term care system, and we advocate for changes that improve residents' lives, including their quality of care. And we oppose Senate Bill 857 because we really believe that it would undermine the adult foster care home's duty to provide care and protection to a very vulnerable population. You know, one of the things about the model of adult foster care, it is different from other caregiving situations. And what you have is typically, and actually statutorily, is that you have an owner-operator or a designated resident manager who assumes primary caregiving responsibilities. And then they may hire what they call substitute caregivers to assist with caregiving or to provide respite. And among the rights of the residents in these kinds of facilities is that they have a right to a safe and secure environment, and they have a right to be free from abuse. And what's so troubling about Senate Bill 857 is that
it doesn't consider issues as indicated by Mary Gear about whether the facility hired appropriately, whether the employee has been retained appropriately, whether they've been trained appropriately, or whether they've been supervised adequately. None of those things are considered in the bill in terms of determining that under certain circumstances the complaint would not be substantiated. And so one of the things that we have found and seen as we've looked at licensing and violations of foster care is that it is not infrequent for adult foster care homes to employ people who have not who do not have a completed criminal history clearance. They employ people who don't have that may or may not have met the requirements for minimal training, and it is in fact one of the most often cited licensing and violations. So what happens is you can have a situation where substitute caregivers are left in charge of a home for extended periods of time, or we have even had occasions where substitute caregivers have been left because the resident manager or the owner operator has abandoned the home. And the problem is that Senate Bill 857 would exacerbate that problem of unqualified caregivers caring for individuals in the homes, because it permits the facility to essentially get a free ride and not get a substantiation of any wrongdoing unless someone is actually harmed. And so in closing, we just believe that this bill will lead us in the wrong direction in terms of accountability for protecting a very vulnerable population. And residents need that, and the public has come to expect that. And I don't see that bill furthering those objectives. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Would you like to get together and see if we can work something out on this? I'm sorry for those of you who came to testify. Time has run out. We have another committee meeting that starts at 5 o'clock. We have to be out of this room at 5 o'clock. And hopefully there will be something that you can work on. So I will go ahead and close the public hearing, and I will adjourn.